I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. About a decade ago, Lorraine Carey's life was turned upside down when her 100-year-old grandmother moved in with her and her family. Her health was failing, and she was worried about Nana's safety and well-being. In her new memoir, Lady Sitting, Lorraine Carey writes about the daily challenges and frustrations of caring for her ailing and often demanding grandmother and the moments of humor, ritual, and intimacy. When she was a little girl, her grandmother's home had been a refuge from her parents' angry marriage, her parents' demands on her, and their punishments. The book also explores her family's history, their migration north from the Jim Crow South, and the weight and value of family obligations. Lorraine Carey wrote the libretto to a one-act opera, The Gospel According to Nana, based on Lady Sitting, and we will be playing an excerpt of that later on in the hour. Lorraine Carey founded Art Sanctuary in 1998, dedicated to celebrating Black arts here in Philadelphia. Also has a safekids.com organization, and she teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. Lorraine Carey, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I'd love to have you read from the very beginning the preface to your new book.
Sure. Why was it that weekends at Nana Jackson's felt like a world apart? Maybe because, dressed in old ball gowns, I traveled with the sun patch across the floor of the suburban New Jersey neocolonial and soaked in more light and luxe than my parents' West Philadelphia apartment could ever offer. Delight and thyme, the wide-armed, fragrant mimosa to climb in summer, the fireplace to stoke in winter, and choices all the day long, whatever your little heart desires. Yes, yes, yes. I knew that I was being spoiled. That word that obsessed Black grown-ups and even kids. What could be worse than to be spoiled, ruined by indulgence, incapable of withstanding hardship as we had done and would do in future? We were brought up by hand as surely as Pip in Great Expectations and much prouder of it than he. You spoiled could get you a corrective beat down. Fast. Besides, everybody needed to respect authority, learn limits, and above all, to know that older Black people valued you, that they loved your undeserving Black behind enough to bring you back from wrong to right. I knew myself to be a wimp, a failure in the toughness category, which was why I went insane with terror at the sound of my mother coming for me or my father reaching for the threatened, though seldom used, belt. If a kid down the street got a beating, and in our cheek by jowl row houses we heard each one, I'd be good for a month. So believe you me, as my mother would say before administering some firm guidance by hand, I knew good and well that my whole Nana deal was off the charts spoiling. Which was why, with peers, I kept it to myself. Hey, what happened in West Collingswood stayed in West Collingswood. Nana's weekend abundance did not feel unconditional by any means. Our contract was that I would occupy myself while she got things done, and then she'd spoil me. But the time alone felt more like Sabbath, as if God visited me occasionally in those sun patches and let me curl up to its presence.
I love the beginning of your book. It says so much, including this relationship that you had with your Nana. How specifically did she spoil you? As you said, it was kind of just this freedom that you felt.
I felt freedom. I felt time. You know, there's a book recently about introvert children, raising introvert children. And part of the what I felt was spoiling, I now recognize as time alone. She was someone who liked her time alone. I recognized in her Charles Dickens's I hate to say it, Scrooge definition of someone who was solitary as an oyster.
Oh, wow.
She understood that. I understood it. She was fine with leaving me alone. She'd give me stuff and then just let me have fun. They gave me a record player, and I was allowed to play records, put the needle on myself, take it off, look at them. I was allowed to wear old cloth and dresses, to play a piano. She had a suburban home. We lived in the city, so I was also allowed to just go out in the yard by myself for hours, roll over rocks, find insects.
But what you also say in that is that, at least among a lot of Black families, that spoiling a child could put them at risk, that a child needed to know what the rules were and needed to abide by them, obey them, because it was a risky world out there.
Oh, yeah. Put your hands up.
Right.
Put your hands on the wheel. I mean, we're talking about this now. So I'm writing about something that happened in the 50s. We're still talking about it now. And in each generation, there are new forms, new visages for the threat. And it is a threat to African-American, to assertion of equality. And any of those assertions,
it's okay.
I'm getting all upset. I'm
You're
flying my
hands
around.
It's
here.
Okay.
You know, that we have all kinds of words for that assertion of equality. We call it, you know, uppity. We call it arrogant. We, I mean, America. So just to have time when I didn't have to think about that.
Right.
Felt free.
I mean, the way you write about your grandmother, your Nana, I mean, it seemed as if you did have a special relationship. You would go to the Philadelphia Orchestra with her.
Yes.
She seemed to love you in a way that she didn't seem to love her son, your father. As he said to you, she never loved me.
He did.
That's how he felt.
He said that. I'll put it into context. He said that once. I was shocked by it because we had lived so closely to her and he had worked so closely with her. I don't know how part of writing this book was to try to understand these relationships among people who were very close but often not intimate.
Yeah.
And I felt, as I got to be a grown-up, that my job was to figure out how to have an intimate relationship. And on this side, I didn't see it. There was closeness. It felt like love. What I say in that introduction is it wasn't unconditional.
Right.
And to decide when was it love and when was it pleasure, when was it indulgence, when those are not the same things. I love you because you do this for me. I love you because you do party tricks. It's not love, and it doesn't see you through the hard times.
Yeah,
you also, and death is the hard time.
Absolutely, and we'll get to the
yeah,
death
right,
part.
Right. We'll get to the death part.
I'm sorry about that, but you
let's
also say,
yeah,
let's do life, and then we'll get to death. You describe her as someone who could pass for white.
Yeah.
And you even describe, again, going to the Philadelphia Orchestra and strangers would look at the two of you together. And I guess the question was, well, what is this about?
Sure,
right?
Sure, sure. And this was, as I say, before people started bringing out their Obama-style grandchildren. You know, if they had them, they did not bring them to the pool at the Marriott and say, look at my grandchild, ha ha. You know, come here, Khalil. They didn't do that. So people looked at her. Was she grandmother? Was she mother? How had this happened? What would be her response to their withering glances?
And was it withering? Did it feel like withering?
Often it did. Mm-hmm. It did. And the reason I looked at her was like, whoa, how are you responding to this? And her response was as if they were not there.
Oh, wow.
I don't see you. Come on, Lorene, let's sit down. Come on, darling, let's sit down.
I mean, we shouldn't be surprised that in African-American families there are so many shades. As you said, I think there was maybe her sister who did pass for white.
Yes.
I mean, sort of disappeared into the...
So, Marty, here's the thing.
Yeah.
America is an African-American family. And in white families, people who think they're white, 25% of them have an African ancestor. So in America, this whole thing is it's a spectrum. Everybody's on the spectrum.
I like that.
Yeah.
The racial spectrum.
That's what I learned from being in this family.
Your book is about this year that you spent with your grandmother. She was 100 years old, and you could see, I mean, she had some medical issues, and it was pretty clear that she just was not going to be living in this house in New Jersey by herself and to be safe. And it also sounded as if the decision for her to live with you was, yes, it was Plan B, but it's not like you had planned Plan B.
No, it wasn't. It was Plan B surprise. It was she had decided that the way she wanted to live and die was as her father. And, you know, I always said that she had a sort of a near-death haiku, which, because I'm on the radio, I won't remember and get exactly right. But her idea was that you would eat your supper, wash your teeth. She always said wash your teeth rather than brush them. Wash your teeth, go to bed, and not wake up.
The perfect death, right?
Perfect.
I mean, who wouldn't want that in a way? that's what she wants.
That's what her father, and she decided that's how it was going to be. And so long as she worked and stayed in that house and managed and did her workarounds, all of which were horribly unsafe. Yes, it was unsafe for her to come back, but it had been unsafe for years. I used to leave, and she would either I had helped her upstairs, and we knew that there would be no way she could get back downstairs in case of an emergency. Mm. Or she would wave goodbye, you know, and I knew that she was going to get herself up on her bottom, backwards up the steps.
Did you have to, in a sense, trick her out of her house, or did she come compliantly?
She came because of social work, because she was in the hospital. The social workers asked about her going back and before the hospital lets you out, they ask, what do you have in place? And there was no way it was either going to be they sent her to some sort of nursing facility that they would choose, or we would, you know, while we found something else, or do you have someplace else you can go? So that was
And that's when you raised your hand, said, essentially.
Well, my husband and I had talked about it. We talked, my sister had talked about it and said, you know, I can do it here. You know, but she's in Montclair, the house is here. So we had all kind of talked. Everybody had talked about it but Nana.
Yeah.
By the way.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest today on Radio Times is Lorraine Carey. She's got a new book. It's a memoir called Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. Her grandmother lived to be more than 100, 100 and she made it to 101. And the book is about Lorraine Carey's family, extended family, her close family, and what it was like to care for her Nana. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Lorraine Carey about her new book, her memoir, Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. Lorraine Carey's very first book was also a memoir called Black Ice. She's written a number of novels in between. She founded Art Sanctuary here in Philadelphia, SaveKidsStories.com, and she teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. Did you think when you decided to bring your 100-year-old grandmother in to live with you and your family that you would be providing the kind of refuge that she provided for you as a little girl? Did you see it that way?
I'm sure that I felt a chance to share, give back what had felt, what feels like, obligation is the word that's coming to mind, but it was that plus It was duty. It also felt like a gift I had been given that I wanted to share.
She was. This is your grandmother I'm talking about. I mean, she was not an easy woman.
No,
Can we say that?
No, she was demanding. It's also one of the reasons why we knew it would not work for her to live in an institution. Some people play well with others. Some people don't.
Well, and lady sitting, obviously a variation on, I guess, babysitting,
yes,
right? The
yes.
idea of yeah. having, and you hired people in part to help take care of her.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she fired a number of them and was difficult with a number of them.
Oh, it was awful. It was just this parade. It was horrible. You know, there are all these services that bring people to you, and they've had, you know, names, you know, Helping Hands, Angels on Wheels, they don't call it, but stuff
yeah.
like that. And people come. And they have their own personalities and their own. And what the administrators say is sometimes it'll take a few folks to make a match. And the people know that. So they look at extroversion, introversion. They look at senses of humor, cooking, activity level, like all of that stuff. All these people, professionals, they know what they're doing. They,
right.
you know, so they came in. But if they were not perfect, if they were not able to do exactly what she wanted and anticipate her needs, it was game over.
In fact, I think it was your daughter who said, you know, Nana can be really mean.
Yeah, yeah. That became, she would catch me when I came in. She had been there from 3:30 to 5 or 6 when I got back. She had watched what happened, and generally the report was Nana had been mean or not mean that day. That's
yeah.
that's how it went. Yeah.
One of the women, Carlene, you ask her, say, they had a good relationship. And,
yes.
and you asked her, so what did you do? I guess trying to understand why did this work and other ones didn't. And she said, in general, I was able to make her wishes my commands without appearing obsequious. She loved my company and my personality. I especially remember how much she loved my accent.
Which was hilarious because Nana always said, I don't like accents. but it was, and I asked this of Carlene when I was writing this book.
Right.
And she said to me, let me take some time and write you back an answer. And that's what she wrote to me. And specifically that business of wish my command without being obsequious. That, you know, that's like a... That's a model for so many relations, so many power relationships. That's a traditional wife model.
Yeah.
That's a child model. That's an employee model where will and what I want is valued more than collaboration, advice, help. It's where the work is not central, but what I want. My pleasure is central.
Was she mean to you?
No. She was not mean to me. There was one time, sometimes she was off in an offhand, but no.
She didn't mean it? I mean, you did.
Right. No, never. And the moment she realized she had slipped over into that other person with me, she pulled back. However, there was one time, and it was toward the end, she was not getting enough oxygen. If she took out the oxygen cannula, then, and she was so afraid of death at the end. So, and the hospice people always told us, our hospice people, for her, the people we'd had with my in-laws in Iowa, all of them gave us interesting wisdom and insight into all the many things that happen to people, including some that are feel paranormal to us, and they have dreams and remembering people from the past, hearing voices, all that stuff is happening. So we're living our day-to-day life.
Sure.
Meanwhile, that person in the room next to you is... You know, is getting these flashes from 1932, from a former divorce, from a moment when other people die. They're hearing stuff. They're seeing things out of these ears that can't hear you well, out of these eyes that can't see. And on one occasion, when she woke up, didn't have her food, didn't have her coffee, didn't have her oxygen in, and she was just certain that I was impersonating that I was some demon, some other character impersonating me. And that was the only time, you know, she grabbed my hand. She tried to wrestle me down. My husband came in and talked to her because she could always hear his voice without her earphones. And we talked to a microphone and earphone. She could always hear his voice. He could calm her down some. But at some point, I mean, I went to get her a cup of coffee. He said, "Lorraine, let Lorraine get you this." I got the coffee. I brought it back to her just exactly as she liked it, exactly the right heat, exactly the right sweetness. And she stopped and looked at me and said, oh, Lorraine, you've had a cold." Now, that she remembered because I had a cold that week. "And I know your throat must be dry. Here, why don't you drink this coffee? Have a sip of this first." And I, for the first time, I lost it with her. And
because she thought maybe you were going to
poison her
with a cup of coffee.
Right.
So she wanted you to be the taster,
yeah,
right?
You want to put you and try that on me? No, you drink it first.
Right.
B. I shouted at her and said, "You know what? I don't play mind games. I don't give them and I don't take them. You don't like this coffee, throw it in the pot. But I'm not, you know, because her potty chair was right there." Mm-hmm. I said, "But I'm not going to drink it first. You make your decision." And I slammed it down. And she just dissolved into tears. She said, "Oh, honey, the fix I'm in, I couldn't trust the Lord Jesus Christ."
So she was in this other world that was sort of taking her from you.
Yeah.
I mean, on the one hand, we can laugh about it, right? I mean, at the moment, you were clearly hurt and angry about it. I mean, and there are those moments, I guess, when that all comes together at the same time.
Yeah, I was furious. We laughed about it very soon after. I mean, once she snapped back to herself, then we could laugh about it. But I felt like her script, you know, we all have these scripts we have in life that we go according to that script. And hers was that at the end, at bottom, it's every person for herself.
Yeah.
You know, her mother had died when she was 6 years old, and she felt like you got to do it yourself. And at the end, it was survival versus intimacy. That was her script.
There's so much in this book that's just so honest and real, and one of the reasons that I loved it so much, because I felt it's so easy to kind of sugarcoat what it's like to be with someone when they're dying, and maybe we don't even know sometimes that they're dying, but that they are. And at one point she says to you, you want me dead.
Yeah.
And you write that part of you had it with her.
And what I try to do is, usually I try to write the memoir like you do reporting, creative nonfiction reporting. You know, God help my poor students, show, don't tell, show it, shut up.
Right.
Don't do too much writing. But at that point I needed to write it very specifically, because what I wanted was I wanted the collapse, the slide into this person who was so desperate that she would throw, it was like watching somebody go over the Khyber Pass, and she would throw everything off the wagon, everything, everybody, just to get through that pass. Well, there is no getting through the pass. You're 101.
Right.
Everything is failing. There's no getting through the pass. But she had no anchor, no way, no place to hold, so that she could stop throwing things. I wanted to stop that. I wanted to, you know, people talk about dying with dignity and blah, blah, blah.
Or good death.
Or good death and all that stuff. But when you are clinging and rock climbing your way, and you're so afraid. Yes, I wanted that done. I didn't know what else, and I also didn't know what more was my capacity. My husband had been great. My kids were great. My sister was coming when she could. Everybody was doing. My dad was coming. And I know it was difficult for him, and he would stay with her. Everybody was doing the best they could, and none of us, and it was not good enough.
Yeah.
And we were all exhausted.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Lorene Carey, our guest on Radio Times today. She's got a new memoir, a book called Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. And her grandmother lived to 101. In fact, I guess died shortly after President Barack Obama was elected president. She got to vote for him via the mail. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A Facebook comment from Edie. It was an honor to take care of my mother in the last months of her life. She modeled it for me by taking care of her mother and mother-in-law when they needed it. The roles were reversed. At one point when she was on hospice, she said to me, "When you were little, I took care of you this way, and now you're the mommy and I'm the baby." Hmm. Talk about role reversals. I mean, when you get to this point, who knows who's the mom and who's the baby?
Except I hear that a lot, and sometimes my mom and I talk about it a bunch. My mom was in the hospital for a bit this week, and we talked about it, and she'll say to a nurse, "She's my mother."
It's very clear, right?
And she says, "Oh, I have two children now. I have two mothers." And but the fact is that it is very different, because you're raising your child to go to something else that neither one of you know. Well, in that way, it's different, you know.
Yeah.
But you're not – you don't have your parent is growing to deal with these last things. And there is a lot of last life growth. But your child is growing in all kinds of different ways in order to go into a lot. It's a very different feeling.
Yeah. Just sort of the known – the known unknown and the unknown known, or some
yeah,
version
like that,
of
like
that.
That right.
I have been with people who have taken their last breath, my mother in particular, where being with her and literally watching what I didn't realize at that moment was her last breath. And I saw, and I'm wondering for you with your grandmother, I saw life leave her body. At that moment, when that last breath was done, it was so clear that something had left her. And I wonder with your Nana, whether you saw that or experienced that.
I did. I wish I could pull up, I feel like Mueller with the things. I wish I could pull up that exact paragraph.
Ooh.
Because I won't talk about it so well as I, but yes, I did. My daughter and I were together, and we felt it, we saw.
I'm looking at around 232, maybe?
Yeah, 233, yeah.
233, okay.
May I?
Sure. Oh, I know what you're reading, yes.
Okay. One woman pressed her lips together and nodded. This is in the hospice. "That's the death rattle," she whispered very quietly. "You may need to give her permission to go. Some people need permission." Zoe, that's my younger daughter who had stayed after everybody else had to go and take care of dogs and houses and other people. Zoe and I nodded appreciatively, even though we knew Nana did not want our permission. Simeon sat in the temple waiting because God had promised him that he would not die until the promised Savior appeared. What was Nana waiting for? What had she been promised? What was she afraid of? After all this time together, I didn't know, but I wished I did. Instead, I listened to the rattle in her lungs, as if something hard were forming, as if all the resentments and hurts and the bitterness were being reduced by this terrible last effort. She was her own life kiln, drying out what was left, so that she could breathe it out into the room that now smelled of her death breath and of us and our living bodies that were breathing her in. Take, breathe, This is the last bit I can squeeze from my body. This is life, just life. The fact of it, like yoga says, like Hebrew says, like language and song and dreams. Like you hear in the wind and the trumpet, one more breath. This is time. Don't you get it? You who had asthma and thought when your lungs clamped down that you had to give up, listen to this rattling around in me still. This is life. I will ring every breath, every second, for these last moments allotted to me. Heart beats, brain works, I breathe.
That's beautiful. Sort of capturing that moment of last breath.
And people die differently. She was working hard for that. Some people just let it go. Every breath, she pulled it in. She had core muscles. She was breathing hard as she could right to the end.
She died so more than a decade ago, I guess, right?
2008. Yeah. November 23rd.
Okay. How much do you think about your Nana? I mean, you wrote a book about her, but how much is she in your life?
A little less now that I've written the book. I think I needed to do this to understand. I wrote a memoir before because it was a significant – it was another two-year period of my life that had changed me that I didn't understand well enough. And I felt this too. I needed to write it to understand it. I'll still think of things. Mm-hmm. The other day I thought – and it's in layers now. I did that thing that you do forever, like something occurs and you think, oh, I should call. I still did that. I saw something. I was teaching in London for Penn, and I saw something she would have liked very much. As a, you know, I was buying little gifts for people. And
let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Lorene Carey. And again, she's got a new book, a memoir called Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. And you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain talking with Lorene Carey. She teaches creative writing at the University of Pennsylvania, the author of a number of novels, including Pride, The Price of a Child, If Sons, Then Heirs, a memoir written back in, I think, 1991 called Black Ice. Her new memoir is Lady Sitting, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century. Lorene Carey, also the founder of SafeKidsStories.com and Art Sanctuary. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. This book is also about your family coming from, you had part of your family came from Barbados, another part that was in the Jim Crow South. Your grandfather on your Nana's side was a cotton farmer, right? Do I have that right?
He was my grandmother's grandfather.
Your grandmother's grandfather.
Right. He was one of what they called free people of color in North Carolina. You could only be so free if you were of color in North Carolina. But he was not enslaved, which was a huge difference and advantage. When the Civil War came, he already owned a little bit, and he was able to buy land. Mm-hmm. His sons, he raised his sons to be gentlemen, sent them to Howard University.
Wow.
For prep school and then for university. One went to law school. That was my grandmother's father, my great-grandfather. The other became a teacher and a principal at a normal school in the area, so that they went into those places, even which their father really respected. Both of them became wildly active in the Republican Party at the time, which in North Carolina, they were doing what they called they were trying to decide between fusion politics, straight up what are the alliances? Can we make alliances with white Republicans? What will be good? What are the little footholds we can get? Can we get black postmasters in? Because that's a particular job that will let us then go deeper into local politics in a way that people won't find threatening. All these were what they were doing. And they were also, each of them, the older brother and the younger, were secretary to Congressman White, who was the last black congressman in the House between in 1902. And that's because by that time, Jim Crow, the poll taxes, the KKK, what Jan Carew calls total war, all of it had the grandfather clauses, had succeeded in disenfranchising these new black voters.
So they went north. Yeah. I mean, part of that, what we call the Great Migration, for your family, I guess, ending up in Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia, 33rd Street,
In West Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I mean, was there someone here that drew them here, or did they
Congressman White.
Okay.
Congressman White. He left Congress. By the way, he did a speech that said, this may be the black person's leaving. He entered into the House the first anti-lynching bill. It never got out of committee, of course, because they wouldn't let it, but he put it in. He said, the Negro will arise phoenix-like again. And Barack Obama read that speech to the Congressional Black Caucus all these years later. So he, when he left, he came to, first he went to Philadelphia and New Jersey. The town along the shore called Whitesboro is named for him. He and a group of men, African-American men, incorporated that town. They incorporated the first black bank in Philadelphia. They had a Citizens Republican Club. They did all these things in Philadelphia, and after trying to stay in North Carolina a little bit longer, Will Higgins brought his family north to Philly, too.
To Philly as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, knowing that about your family, then your grandmother, your Nana, really comes into strong relief when you see sort of where she came from and her determination to live her life.
Yes. Yes, and. He was a race man. He was about moving the race forward. The generation after made that choice. Are we going to work for total civic engagement, or are we going to take this freedom we've been given and try to live our life and have a nice house and, you know, buy proper nylons when the rationing ends?
Yeah.
And I think that she took that path, which, as I grew up, felt to me like, when I looked at it, I thought, "What? We don't yet have that privilege. That feels like a." Sometimes in America, the idea is that that's what white people can do. I disagree. If there's injustice, it doesn't matter on your race. You know, we need to do better. That's what our founding principles say, right? So let's do better.
It seemed, though, that your grandmother protested in her own way against the kind of rules within her family, or even with her first husband. I think I have this right. Didn't want her to drive.
He said women shouldn't. Women couldn't drive.
And
she
snuck around him, and she learned to drive, and she got a driver's license, and he never knew anything about it.
She kept that license in her drawer, and it was particular. She kept it in her underwear drawer, like right under her brassieres. Right. So if it wasn't close to her heart, it was close to her heart. And she was just waiting. She was waiting for the time when he would say something, and then And he did. They had an argument. Yeah. He said, you can't even drive. And she went up there and brought this thing down. And she would always tell this story to me, holding her fingers aloft as if that license were between her thumb and index finger. I showed it. You yeah. showed him. Yeah, I showed him.
I mean, freedom, right? I mean, having a license means you can get away.
It means you can get away. But what you can't get away from is a relationship where you can't tell each other what the hell you're doing.
Yeah. This is a weird segue, but you... this is from the opera, The Gospel According to Nana. You wrote the libretto. The music is by Lilia Ugay. Do I have that?
Yes, Lilia Ugay.
On the piano, performed by Ivana Chu, who plays Nana's ghost. Scheherazade Pankathi is the granddaughter, composer Jean Stenger. This is just about 50 seconds, but there is an opera based on our guest book, The Gospel According to Nana. And this is a section where Nana is essentially sneaking around so she can learn to drive.
And she's telling this story to her granddaughter.
Let's listen. Like that. It's wonderful. And it fits so beautifully with your story.
Lilia Ugay was wonderful making that. She had different themes in it. And that's the Nana theme. Yeah. It's very traditional. Other parts of the opera are very modern. But that was her theme.
Let me get Joan from, it looks like Joan from Elkins Park to join us on Radio Times. And Joan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was actually your hospice social worker.
Oh.
And oddly enough, I am just about passing your house right now. And I always think of you and your grandmother and what wonderful, wonderful care you gave and what a loving granddaughter you were. I bought your book, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I have shared it with many people.
Well, Joan, you've made us both cry. Thank you so much for calling in. And
Me too.
And you too as well. All three of us are crying, so that's probably a very good day here on Radio Times.
I hope you're happy, Joan.
Look what
you
did.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
I just had to call and tell you.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I'm glad you did, Joan.
Thank you for sharing your story. Pardon?
No, I was going to say, I think that the relationship between hospice workers and the people that they care for, and then the extended family, is such an intimate and important and powerful relationship. Can you speak to that, Joan?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm actually on my way to a patient now. And, yeah, it's just everybody's different, and yet there's something that moves you in every situation, and it's just such a blessing to be doing this work.
Well, that's wonderful, Joan.
Yeah, it's a blessing to have people who feel that they're built to do this and are trained and experienced, because for all of us, this is, you know, what I said was like at a wedding, often the liturgy in our tradition says, think about your own marriage, and recommit yourself at a new wedding. And it connects you through this ritual. You're connected through the rituals of dying to other people. But in my life, you know, because I don't live in a war zone, because we have antibiotics, and because we've been so fortunate, you know, how many deaths How much do I know? So part of this book says, okay, there's my mother-in-law, my father-in-law, my great-grandmother, my great-grandfather, my grandmother. Like, so maybe I can count maybe 10 or 12 that I have seen and know. To have somebody who understands mm-hmm. and has seen and says to you, that it's like going to the doctor who says, yes, I know it's a cough, but a cough can also indicate thus and so. So that a hospice worker will tell you all the things I said to you about people hearing. So that when my father-in-law got up, Houdini'd his way out of his pajamas, this man who couldn't move practically, I walk in there, I hear him talking. This is in Iowa, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And he's there, no clothes on. He was the most modest man. He's buck naked. He's sitting on the side of the bed. And he says to me, looking through me, absolutely in the dark, says, has Rudy had his supper yet? And I only knew Rudy because my husband had told me, this is a man who died all these years ago. Has Rudy had his supper yet? And a hospice worker tells you they're getting ready. They're in this other world. Just be with them. And it was a hospice worker who told me what I should say is yes. Yeah, he did.
Joan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Lorene, you mentioned rituals. I mean, and there are a number of rituals that you had with your grandmother, putting some little tea or little sweets by her bedside.
Yes.
So if she if she woke up in the middle of the night, she'd have something to eat.
It's not an if. She always woke up in the middle of the night. She was vigilant to be able to toilet herself. It's one of the ways we know ourselves as grown-ups. She wanted to do that. We put the potty, we rehearsed in the day, like an athlete. Get up, turn, exactly where. She felt it exactly where. We did it over and over, so that in this new house, and a couple times she forgot and got in the wheelchair and tried to go pee in the closet, which was, fell, and it was awful. Mm. But most often, so she'd get up at night, clean the hands, get back, and then she'd reach for her plate. Her plate had exactly three sweets, three different kinds, exactly a certain kind of water, like that, and then she would go back to bed. That's a ritual we created, but it's in the context of the fact that my husband's an Episcopal clergy, and there was ritual, ancient ritual, all the time that we slipped into, that was of some comfort to her, not ultimate comfort, but some.
An email from Bill. My wife and I are in the process of taking care of her mother, a post-stroke progressive dementia 88-year-old. It's been almost 4 years now. Thank you for writing this book that gives voice to all of us out there who are in similar situations and feel frustrated, somewhat resentful, and at wit's end most of the day.
Yeah.
And that is also a part of caretaking.
Wit's end. Bob says that we should put up, my husband who has this naughty wit said that I should have, postcards saying, writing you from Rope's End, Pennsylvania. Yeah, Wits End, Pennsylvania. Bill, do get the postcard. Because being honest about it, at least, doesn't make you feel empty. And you can't, when people say to you, walk up and down, people say, how are you doing? What you can't say is, well, let me tell you, she fell off the pot today, and that was, God, I just wiped up all this. You don't. You say, oh, fine. Mm-hmm. And you get more and more isolated from the workaday world because commerce likes things predictable. So,
Lorene Carey, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Lady Sitting is her memoir, My Year with Nana at the End of Her Century, and is the founder of Art Sanctuary here in Philadelphia, also SaveKidsStories.com, and she teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. Again, thank you very much. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and we did take some photographs of our guest and also our engineer, Al Banks. Radio Times, produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.